In this episode of the podcast, we are joined by Dr. Michaela Reduano, who discusses how political campaigning on social media affected the outcome of the 2016 US presidential election. Has anything changed in 2020 as the US prepares to vote again this November?
Thank you for joining us for the Economic Sounds podcast. Can we start off with just an overview of your main area of research? You look at the political economy. What does that involve, and what does it tell us in terms of the challenges that you're trying to unravel?
Thank you for inviting me, first of all. I take the political economy approach, which look at the interaction between economics and political process. In other words, the starting point is that there are rational citizens. Obviously, we can argue that citizens may not be rational at all, but you know, the starting point is citizens are rational and have preferences over determined economics outcome that are induced by given policy choices. These policy choices are delegated to elected policymakers, elected representatives, and we may or may not have in the same interest as the elected citizen, and that may be more informed. So there is an asymmetry of information between voters and the policymaker. And this gives rise to, you know, a series of problems which we're looking into it. And then finally, we've got political institutions that shape the whole process. So in summary, economic choices are not the outcome of a complex interaction process of interaction between various agents. So we also can complicate the picture. We can introduce, like, you know, the effect of interest groups, lobbies, and so on. So as you can see, the outcome is very complicated. It's not taken as a textbook, like, you know, a benevolent social plan makes all, like, the optimal decision for a citizen.
So would it be fair to say that if economics is the study of how people make decisions, political economy is looking at how people make political decisions?
Yeah, I would say that's correct. Individual decisions are more complicated if we move into a political sphere where we have to take collective decisions, so not individual decisions, and these are usually the decisions delegated to policymakers.
And presumably one of the important challenges there is, are people acting from correct knowledge or from broad knowledge or even from any knowledge at all? So one of your recent projects was looking into social media and how people get their news and the impact that may or may not have had on the choices that they made on voting. Can you tell us a little bit more about that research?
Yes, we are looking at how social media, and in particular Facebook, may affect election outcome, voting decision process and so on. So we focus on political advertising, which is a form of campaigning that allow candidates to directly convey messages to potential voters and influence the political debate. By running political ads on various types of social media, candidates may reach voters that were not able to reach in a more traditional, conventional way, and bring attention to important political issues. Regarding social media in particular, is social media enter in the political arena in 2008 when Barack Obama was elected in President of the United States, but raised enormous importance in 2016 when Trump was elected. Just to give you some figures, for example, to highlight the importance of social media, and in particular Facebook, in the political campaign, the Pew Research Center estimate that in 2016, over 70% of US voters at the Facebook account, and a large majority of those citizens and voters were using Facebook and social media to collect political information. So that's give you kind of an idea of the enormous platform audience that candidates were able to reach via social media. But a specific characteristic of Facebook or social media is that the political advertiser can reach voters in a very granular way through what is called political micro-targeting.
So could you just explain what micro-targeting is? I think obviously in the UK we might think about a party political broadcast that goes out on the TV and is seen by everybody in a certain area. this is clearly something that's a lot more detailed than that.
Yes, my micro-targeting is very important. It's a distinctive characteristic of social media and Facebook, and this makes this social media platform very different from all the other traditional platforms like, you know, TV, radio, or the printed papers. Because what is micro-targeting? We can define micro-targeting as a marketing strategy that, thanks to sophisticated technologies, allowed to exploit a vast amount of user-generated data, for example, information on individual interest, network, group of friends, and a behavioral pattern. And all these data are collected and can be used by the political advertising to send very personalized messages to group of voters.
So if Facebook knows that I'm interested in, I don't know, home security, or I've shared some information about law and order in my town, then a campaign might think about sending me messages focused on what they would do in order to, I don't know, give more money to the police or to tackle domestic problems like that.
Yes, that's absolutely true. I mean, if you are a political advertiser or advertiser in general, you can go to Facebook and select various characteristics, which can be geographical location, your town where you live, but also your interest. And like, if your interest is environment, you're probably more likely to, you know, receive messages related to that and so on. So in this way, Facebook can reach voters in a very specific way. On top of that, in 2016, Facebook, thanks to a very sophisticated and apparently successful and accurate algorithm, started classifying each users according to the political ideology. So each Facebook user were mapped by Facebook in a way that it was not, in a way that, you know, users were not aware of. They weren't declared their political preferences, but based on what they like, with what page they visited, the network of friends, they were mapped into conservative, liberal, very conservative, and so on. So they were, for this reason, the political advertisers were able to use this information to send, you know, specific messages to each user.
And that presumably is incredibly valuable to a campaign, to be able to tailor its messages so carefully.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely.
And what did you find, what did your research tell us about how the campaigns were using this opportunity? And what impact it had on the act, if you know, what impact it had on voting choices or the outcome?
Yeah. First of all, I want to stress the fact that getting any data on political micro-target is a very hard task, because these data are private property of Facebook that, you know, doesn't like to share this information with a researcher or the, you know, political institution and so on. So we kind of circumvent this problem by collecting advertising prices, which through a demand-supplier relationship were able to give us an idea of the intensity of the political campaign to each group of individuals in each US state. And then what we did, we link this data to a survey, American National Election Survey, of the US voters. And we analyzed the behavior of this voter according to whether or not they had Facebook account, whether they use it Facebook account regularly to learn about politics. And what we found, I think it was quite interesting, because we found, first of all, that our data highlighted two main effects. One, that there was a positive effect on voters' turnout, so going to vote, for those who were declared themselves to be Republican and using Facebook, compared to those who were not using Facebook. So according to our analysis, Facebook had a positive effect in convincing voters to cast the ballot. We found an opposite effect on those that were instead liberal voters, so the Clinton core supporter. The second effect is on actual vote. So we found that those who were less informed and usually not very interested in politics were persuaded to vote for Trump significantly. There's no such effect on Clinton.
Were you able to find out, was that the campaign was more effective, or they spent more money, or is this is it a question as the situation where you can see what happened, but the question of sort of why it happened is not so straightforward?
Obviously, we would like to have all this information, but we don't know exactly how we have a bold figure how much Clinton spent and how much Trump spent on social media, because that was declared during the campaign. So Trump spent significantly more than Clinton on social media. Clinton ran a campaign more on using traditional means campaigning. So part of the result could be that Trump invested much more on social media. On the other hand, if we look at where Clinton spent on social media, so we see like high intensity of the campaign from our data, we can see this, there's not much effect. So Trump spent more, but also presumably, you know,
whatever he
analysis suggested they spent better. Evidence, anecdotal evidence says he was able to micro-targeted voter. This is the key success of his campaign. He was able to send his messages to specific messages to those individuals that were not interested in politics traditionally.
Is there any concern that those messages can't be seen? So I know that the US doesn't have the same kind of restrictions on advertising that we do in the UK when it comes to politics. And I know that, I remember that one of the issues Facebook was kind of forced to open in the UK to show the political adverts that had been published. I suppose if you're the opposition, you don't know what's being said, so you can't counter those messages.
This is a key issue. I mean, obviously the problem was raised in 2016, but now in 2020 is not resolved, and there is still debated, and it is very as a key issue. First of all, the social media is not like broadcast radio television, can pick up which advert to put online, you know, while a TV and television are subject to different type of regulation. So in this respect, social media is more similar to the regulation, newspaper regulation, okay? But the key difference is that why newspaper is published is available to everybody, everybody can read, and, you know, they start a debate. Social media messages are hidden, and each person receive potentially a very different message, and you cannot check what your neighbor's receiving. So that makes social media much more dangerous in this respect, because there's not a way of verifying whether a news is fake or is true, is biased, unbiased, and so on.
So it's putting a lot of responsibility on the voters to almost work that out for themselves. That's quite a challenge, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, voter, in principle, I mean, having being subject of lots of different information is a good thing, because voters should become more informed and make up their minds. But on the other hand, when voters are only subject to one type of information, because they're presumably targeted by same type of advertiser, you know, they are not able to understand that this is not their reality, but it's their own, what is called, bubble.
Okay. Did you find out anything about sort of trust, that trust in the media is declining? But do people feel that their social media is a place where they get information that's trusted? Perhaps it's shared by friends, or... did anything come up on that sort of angle in your...
Well, we didn't look at in particular that in our research, but what is clear actually from our research, that people that were not interested in politics before, you know, they were not buying newspaper or, you know, following talk show and so on, are now much more, you know, influenced by political debate through social media, to their friends, as you said, through friends and, you know, their network. So in this respect, we can say that social media has increased, has reached those people that were not interested. On the other hand, you know, what kind of messages are these people receiving? So
just don't know, do we? And your work was the previous election, 2016, and now we're in the run-up to 2020. Do you think anything will change? I can't imagine that it will become any less important to do this targeting of the voters. Has there been any steps forward in transparency or in regulation?
Well, there is undoubtedly, I think the social media are still important and will be even more important, because I mean we saw an exponential growth in people like using social media from, for example, 2012 to 2016. Users are growing. Young generation are using social media more and more and are reading newspaper less and less. So definitely, you know, as a platform has got, you know, enormous potential. There has been a debate among, you know, policymaker, practitioner, you know, the public, the press, how to deal with social media. At the moment, there is not very much in the sense that, you know, Facebook is still self-regulating, has opened up partially by creating an archive where all these adverts, some of the adverts with political content can be seen, observed, and also some information on who has seen this advert and so on. But on the other hand, this is left in the hand of Facebook. So, you know, it's, at the same time, for example, Twitter has declared there's not going to be political advertising on Twitter. Google has limited the extent of micro-targeting to the traditional, like, you know, characteristics such gender or age, but not further in terms of political orientation. But this is left very much to each single platform. At the level of government, it's very difficult. I was talking to someone Ofcom recently, and they were very well aware of the problem. They're trying to deal as the best they can, but this is a very international problem. Mm-hmm. Think about all these adverts, paid adverts from Russia that were, you know, paid to influence U.S. elections. So, you know, a single country cannot be very effective. You know, there is a need for international coordination, mm-hmm. and, you know, it takes time. Mm-hmm. It takes time.
Yes, always. And your work, you just mentioned there, actually, the international aspects of this work. The study that we've been talking about was specifically on the USA. Are you looking to see if the same patterns can be seen outside the US in other elections?
Yes, we would like very much. We have put together, I believe, a quite interesting research project with a group of academics from Bocconi University, ATH Switzerland, and Bath and Loughborough, among others, and Carlos Elcero in Madrid. So it's kind of international team of researchers, but need money. So we apply for funding, and hopefully we will be able to do some interesting work on European election and the effect of social media on people's political behaviour.
Do you see this as potentially problematic for democracy? We can imagine a utopia where social media means everyone's got access to good information, sound information, and they all read widely and make good decisions based on that. But it's very vulnerable, as you mentioned earlier, to perhaps disinformation from international other states wanting to bend things in their direction. Is it a problem for democracy?
It's definitely a challenge. There is definitely a threat for democracy, but at the same time, there is also social media open up enormous like possibility to improve democracy in the sense to provide better information to citizens, reach those citizens or the individual who are not interested in politics. Mm-hmm. So in this respect, we'd increase democracy. Obviously, there is a need for regulation and coordination among nations, such that, you know, false information is not sent to citizens and misled for true information. Mm-hmm. So,
And is this a good example, in a way, of how economic research can really address a fundamental social question? So good democracy and electing the people that won the contest fair and square is vital to the world, really, isn't it? And your study has shown a possible challenge, something that could be addressed by governments if they choose to, and just shown what's actually happening. Is the impact of this really something that encourages you?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we have observed in the last few years some very surprising electoral results around the world. You know, we're talking about Trump or, you know, populist leader that are elected, or, you know, even Brexit, many people couldn't believe that the morning that it happened. And so why did it happen? I think the first question, what, you know, is social media affecting this surprising result or not? Why did it happen? I mean, it's fine if that's what people want, inform people want that. That's fine. That's democracy for you. But, you know, is that the case or not? This is an open question we are trying to address.
Mm-hmm. And when it comes to the teaching that you're doing in the department, is this something that engages the students? I always quite find it difficult because I didn't grow up with social media. It's something that's appeared later on in my life, certainly after sort of, I don't know, political opinions get formed fairly early on, and then social media arrive. But we're looking, you know, the students now, it's been there since birth, hasn't it? Are they interested in how it affects their views? Do they even accept that maybe it does affect their views? Or is it when you're teaching, is this whole issue something that you find is you know, going down well in the classroom?
Yes, I'm teaching a module. Topics in Applied Political Economy. This module is for postgraduate students, so future researchers. And I think when I teach social media, the effect of Facebook on politics is one of the topics that where students are more engaged. And, you know, they're really fascinated by that. There is not much research yet because of lack of data. Hopefully in the future we will be able to, you know, the social media platform will be more open and will share the data a bit more, so we can shed light on what's going on more precisely. But I think, the new generation of researchers are very interested in this, even if they, you know, for them, they were born with that. But still, you know, there's so much to do. So much to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah, among the topic I teach, I think the role of information, media bias, social media is probably what captured the interest of our PhD student.
Mm. Just broadening out slightly beyond sort of the social media and the elections question, what other topics are at the front of your mind at the moment? Have you got plans for new projects?
Yes, another project I'm working on, which I am very interested, is the role of culture, how culture is transmitted from generation to generation, and how this affect our the way we are, the way we behave, the way we vote ultimately. And to answer this question, we look at Italy. Well, I'm Italian, so I guess it's easier for me to work in that environment. So what we start from the you know, previous research that highlights the importance of cultural identity on behaviors, on custom, belief. And most of the study have been done on immigrants, so external immigrants, the second, third generation of people coming from, you know, in the US, especially from other countries. But here in this study, we focus on Italians' interregional mobility. So we look at people living in three cities, three larger cities in Italy, where traditionally, the high proportion of people are coming from abroad, maybe from one generation or more. And we look at the behavior, we analyze the behaviors of these people. And what we find is that the place of origin of their grandparents still matters in the way they behave. Still matter in the way they kind of eat, they kind of what they cook, what they like to eat, on the way that they use the language, but also important is matter in a kind of the way they trust people,
mm-hmm.
The way they, you know, contribute toward like common resources. So, you know, our inheritance, cultural inheritance that from our, you know, parents, grandparents matter a lot. And our grandparents, you know, coming from a given part of Italy, they kind of carry with them the background and transmit that, you know, not obviously through food, the language, but also, you know, in mm-hmm. through what is called social capital, so attitude toward trust, cooperation, and so on. And this is fascinating. And an interesting thing is that, you know, if you ask people, you know, where are you from, people tend to say the town where they live or mm-hmm. they were born. But so that will, with that, you know, stopping at that answer, it won't be able to give us another layer, which is their background, which has come out actually from the way they behave. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that highlights the importance of using this, for example, measure like, you know, like of culture such as food and language to track someone's identity.
Mm-hmm. And possibly their voting choices.
And possibly their voting choices. In fact, we're looking at that, and it does matter the way they vote. I mean, the way they kind of behave, the way they trust politicians, the way they trust people, obviously is different. Therefore, this translates into a different voting behavior, mm-hmm. you know, when they have to decide.
Or your values, I suppose, or the value you might place on community versus
absolutely.
Entrepreneurism.
Absolutely, yeah. And it does matter. Even if these people were born in this town, they are, you know, they still are, they're characterized by something that is different, that is specific to the origin of their family. Mm-hmm. I think it's fascinating.
That's so interesting. I was sort of just thinking in UK terms of that, you know, we have the very famous sort of north-south divide.
Yeah.
And you can come down, I lived in London for a very long time, but I'm from Manchester, before that from Scotland, from industrial Scotland. And that's very different to you know, the person who lived next to me in the flat next door. It's so fascinating. I do think we've sort of run out of time.
Okay.
But perhaps we can come back to that another time. But
thank you.
Thank you for your time. Thank you for joining us on the podcast. And thank you very much.
You're welcome.
You have been listening to Warwick Econ Sounds, a podcast series from the Department of Economics at the University of Warwick. Please follow the link on our website for further information about Dr. Redouano's research.